The art of conversation is not lost. It's what we do at 1A day in and day out. It's what NPR does and has been doing for decades. From day one, we've made you a part of our conversations on 1A. You hear listeners like yourself on our show all the time, and you give us the kind of insights that take what we're talking about to new heights. It's what you expect and, frankly, what you deserve, and 1A and NPR are committed to providing a daily space for that to happen. Right now, we're asking you to give what you can so your local public radio station can keep telling great stories, so we can keep telling your story. Visit donate.npr.org/1A. Thanks. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Time for the last part of our series on modern romance and relationships, Cuffin Season.
My name is Lindsay. I'm from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. I'm 33 years old.
My name is Maria. I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri.
I'm having less sex than I ever have in my entire life.
I am a mother of two. I have a part-time job in a pediatric hospital. And I am a full-time student in a PhD program focusing on pediatrics.
I am a full-time graduate student, and I work two jobs. I also have extracurricular activities, so I would love to be having more sex, but I quite frankly don't have time for it.
So I would guess that my main reason for not having any desire in anything sexual would be sheer exhaustion, stress, and anxiety.
And I know a lot of people my age and my situation who aren't having much luck finding partners while juggling all the other responsibilities of life.
Research tells us that America's 20-somethings are having less sex. You've told us that, too. Check out these messages that came to our inbox.
My name is Grace. I'm 21, from Pennsylvania.
Hello, this is Ida, calling from Orlando, Florida. I am 28 years old.
I do not have as much sex as I wish I were having. I'm in a monogamous relationship of about a year, and his interest in it just kind of waned.
And I think for me, one of the core reasons why I am just not participating in hookup culture is because of the horror stories I've heard from so many of my peers around sexual interactions that did not include consent, that were just very aggressive, unpleasant, what have you.
We saw a sex therapist once. I don't really know if we're going to go back, but we've been trying to talk about it more. We started an intimacy journal where we write to each other instead of talking out loud because we can get emotional, but I really don't know how it's going to go.
For me, the, you know, fear and the risk involved is just too high, and I'd just rather not participate. I think that's something a lot of us can relate to.
Grace and Ida, we appreciate you sharing your stories with us, and they represent just two of the many reasons that young people in America say that they are having less sex than young people did in the past. Joining us here in studio is Kate Julian, a senior editor for The Atlantic. Her cover story on America's so-called sex recession ran in the magazine's December issue. Kate, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joining us from Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, near Chicago, is Dr. Alexandra Solomon. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and clinical assistant professor at the university's Family Institute. She's also the author of Loving Bravely, 20 Lessons of Self-Discovery to Help You Get the Love You Want. Dr. Solomon, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us from Northwestern is Gigi Engel, a certified sex coach, writer, and educator, and also a 20-something. Gigi, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks. So happy to be here.
Kate Julian, let me start with you. When we're talking about this sex recession, what does the research actually tell us? How significant of a recession are we talking about? Is this a recession or is this a depression?
I think recession is at this point probably the fair term to use. And we also have to remember that we're talking about averages, big generational averages. So this doesn't necessarily mean that a given person is having less sex than they did last year. It just means that on average, people in their 20s and in their late teens are having less sex than people, as you said, in previous generations at the same time. They're on track to have fewer lifetime sexual partners. They're like 2.5 times more likely to be abstinent, and they're having sex less frequently.
And so people aren't just having less sex. They're beginning to have sex later in life, right?
That's true as well. So the sort of average age of first sort of sexual experience is about a year later than it was in the early 90s when it sort of hit its historic low.
Are we talking about all age groups having less sex than in the past, just young adults? Does this cut across demographics?
So this is a really interesting question. I used as the springboard for this whole inquiry a series of journal articles by a woman named Jean Twenge, who's a psychologist at San Diego State. She published four journals in the leading sex research journal about various aspects of them. And one of them does suggest that people who are older, so 30s, 40s, and 50s, are also having sex less frequently. 62 times a year on average has dropped down to like 54 times on average over the past 20 years. But the sort of overwhelming sort of data from other sources suggests that there's really something different and clear going on with people in their 20s that seems to be sort of different than for those older groups and a bit more severe.
Kate, I wonder, does this trend also hold consistent regardless of sexual orientation? Is this also happening to gay, straight, bi? Is it kind of across the board?
So there just isn't enough research on the dating and sex experiences of non-straight people to answer that question definitively. There's some interesting research by a guy at Stanford suggesting that on average, young gay and lesbian people are reporting more active dating lives than straight people are, and that would seem to be sort of an increase from in the past, which does raise this sort of intriguing possibility that this is mostly a straight phenomenon.
Let me bring Dr. Solomon and Gigi Angle into the conversation. Dr. Solomon, I can hear parents across the country saying, and thank you, Jesus. Isn't it a good thing?
Well, you know, I think that whenever we take a topic as complicated and nuanced as sexuality and try to plunk it into a category of either good news or bad news, we kind of perpetuate this problem, which is that we're not creating enough nuance around sexuality. Because the other question is, you know, having sex or not having sex is one question, but another one is the quality of the sex. And one of the, I think, exciting possibilities of this time is if we can start to have conversations about actually what good, pleasurable, healthy, wholehearted sexual experiences looks like, we may be on the cusp of a really exciting new time of reclamation.
And I'd love you to respond to a member of our 1A text club who writes, it's a very personal choice, and young people shouldn't be pressured and made to feel they are stunted if they aren't sexual early. Gigi?
I think that waiting till marriage is a personal choice, and if you choose to do that, then there's nothing wrong with that. And I don't think that wondering what the concerns around having sex later might be doesn't necessarily shame somebody who wants to wait to have sex. I think really what we're looking at is not just the kind of sex that people are having or shaming people for having sex when they're having sex. It's more about like why this is happening and the reasons that this might be happening other than, you know, more abstinence-only education is not the answer.
We'll continue our conversation in a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're spending a little intimate time with 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the YMCA, a nonprofit committed to strengthening communities. The Y believes the zip code you're born into shouldn't determine your destiny and works to create opportunity for all, no matter who you are or where you're from. Learn more about the impact of your donation at ymca.net/forabetterus. The Y, for a better us.
Life Kit is kind of like that friend who always has the best tips.
Damn, good and up.
That makes it a little harder.
Like the latest on how to get a good workout.
You didn't think you was just going to get me here just for nothing, did you?
Life Kit. Check it out in Apple Podcasts or at npr.org/lifekit.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are wrapping up our series, Cuffing Season, discussing why people in their 20s are reportedly having less sex. We got quite a number of stories from you about what your sex lives are like these days, including this one that landed in our inbox.
29 years old, Carlsbad, California, definitely having less sex. I just went through a divorce, and being a newly single parent and working multiple jobs, I just don't have the time to invest in meeting somebody, finding out if they're worthwhile to be jumping into bed with.
Thanks very much for sharing your story with us through our app 1A Vox Pop. Let me get to some more of your comments. One listener texted, I am a 26-year-old woman in a 4-year relationship, and I have sex likely once every month or two. I work afternoon shifts during a full-time job, and sometimes I come home and it's the last thing on my mind, even though I'm very attracted to and in love with my boyfriend. Gigi, this theme keeps coming up. I would, but I'm too busy. How much of this is just attributed to the fact that life moves faster?
I think that I get a lot of questions like this in my inbox from readers and from clients who are constantly saying that like they want to be having more sex, or they value sex, but they just don't have the time for it, or they are concerned that they have a higher libido than their partner. I find this especially with clients who say that they're worried that their libido is higher than their partner. They can't understand why they don't want to have sex with them as much as they want to have sex. And I think this all kind of ties back to this myth where men are supposed to be these sexual creatures who want to have sex all the time. They're supposed to be ready to go. And then women are supposed to give in or let their partner have sex with them. Whereas that's a complete lie.
Right.
Men and women both have libidos, and it depends very much on the individual person. It has nothing to do with sex. And then if you are a man who doesn't want to have sex as much as your female partner, you are somehow, quote, less of a man. And if you're a woman who wants to have sex all the time and your male partner doesn't want to have sex all the time, then there must be something wrong with you. So we lack these communication skills where we're able to talk to each other about these differences because we have these, you know, generalizations that are brought around different sexuality.
Yeah, and in reality, the exact same kind of imperatives affect men and women because, you know, men have jobs too, and we get tired too. Another one of our text club members writes, dating apps are more like swiping games, and real life appropriate flirting is hard to come by. Mm-hmm. Dr. Solomon, I'd like for you to respond to this one particularly, that we heard in Ida's voicemail at the beginning of the program, this idea of hookup culture. I wonder how much where you see the roots of that. It used to be we could blame it on movies like Animal House or American Pie, and now it seems like the same issue is attributed to different causes. Do you see that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, hooking up is not new. I always tell my students, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, and I say we used to hook up. Also, we were just wearing our dad's flannel shirts and listening to Pearl Jam. And
there's an image. And for those of you listening now, they knew they were the sexiest thing. You couldn't tell them nothing.
That's
that
right.
Flannel shirt looked great.
So that piece isn't new. What is new is that we're all dealing with this brand new landscape of what does it mean to have these smartphones that have everything on them at our fingertips all of the time. And so I think one of the risks and dangers and shadowy aspects is we can use our phones as crutches. So I was just hearing a story about somebody at a bar, and they see someone who looks really attractive. So they use a location-based app and start frantically swiping in the hopes they can perhaps swipe on this person who's literally 15 feet away. And so that's a place where what we're losing are those kind of old sacred rituals of flirtation and seduction, and what we really need in order to kind of cultivate desire and attraction and romance is to be in real life, in real time. And there's a kind of vulnerability in that that we just can't get around.
Yeah, we had a conversation kind of to that effect with flirting and cruising among gay and bisexual men and how that's changed over time. I think about, you remember the tricorder from Star Trek? That thing that you know what I'm talking about.
So
first of all, I should throw you out of the studio for not knowing Star Trek. There was this device in Star Trek. It was the handheld scanner. You know what a tricorder is.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay,
thank you.
Yes.
It feels kind of like, and you have referred to this as the Tinder mirage.
Yes.
That you can just kind of scan somebody who's near you and figure out everything you need to know. This isn't unique to young people, but I wonder what your sense is of this kind of Tinder mirage, this tricorder effect, as it might be affecting young people and intimacy.
Right. Well, there was this notion when Tinder first came on the scene that it made everything more efficient, right? That you could just sort of cut through a lot of stuff and find exactly what you were looking for. And there were some slightly panicked articles that ran about that. One of them that I'm referring to with that title, it was called the Tinder Apocalypse, which sort of suggested that this would be the death of romance because people would be just, you know, going out there and sleeping with 100 different people, you know, in the course of a year. And what we're seeing is that for some people that it works that way, but for a lot of other people, it can be really paralyzing. It doesn't function as well for people who don't photograph well. That seems obvious, but that's a lot of us. The problem is, I think, you know, also picking up on what Alexandra said, the more we do this, the more it becomes normal, and the more it becomes, for some people, more awkward to sort of chat somebody up outside of that context. Mm-hmm. Because there's this sense that's emerged really very quickly that this is sort of the normal way to do things. And if you talk to somebody sort of, you know, outside of that, there's this ambiguity, like, are they coming on to me? Are right. they interested? Right. And it's very awkward for a lot of people. Very, very awkward.
We heard from a number of you about your experiences with this, including one of our listeners who we wanted to bring into the conversation today. Joining us on the line is a man named Sam Hazelwood. He's 25 years old, single, lives in Virginia. He left a message with his experiences of sex and dating, and it was directly germane to this topic. So we figured we'd have him join us today. Sam, welcome to 1A.
Thank you, Joshua. Happy to be here.
How much of what we've discussed so far with dating apps, let's just start there, how much of that resonates with you and your experience?
You know, it's a pretty spot-on version of what I've experienced.
Give me a sense of how you formed your expectations, Sam, about sex, dating, romance, courtship. Was it mostly through parents, family and friends, church, school leaders, pop culture? How did you kind of learn that as a younger man?
I think it was a little bit of kind of talking with friends and I guess maybe pop culture. It wasn't really a conversation that I had with my parents that often. To say it ignorantly, I guess I kind of just formed it on my own, but I'm sure there was lots of different factors that went into that.
How much did technology factor into that for you? Are you the kind of person who kind of always grew up with computers of various sizes and configurations that were kind of part of your life? How much of it was technology?
So I know when I was in like sixth grade, AIM messaging was the big thing. And I remember talking to my first girlfriend on that computer software. And then I was finally allowed to get a cell phone when I reached eighth grade. And so then once the cell phone came out, it kind of just changed everything. I feel like now it's pretty similar to how it was back then, where you just want to be texting that person at all times. And it kind of contributes to like maybe a lack of trust that is happening, because, you know, you might be texting a person consistently for 10, 20, 30 minutes, and then all of a sudden they just disappear, and you're yeah. like, oh, well, what's going on? Are they cheating on me, or what are they doing without me, kind of thing? So technology definitely plays a role. I would definitely say yes to that.
Sam, you said that you've had women who seemed nervous to meet you. One said that her friends were tracking your location. Is that right?
Yeah, so I have been using Hinge. It's one of the, you know, big three dating apps for about a year now. And seeing as how I live in a smaller city, which my potential partners are kind of limited, I have my location and my radius set pretty large. And so I've driven, you know, over an hour to meet someone before. And I didn't think anything of it. I was like, if I'm going to meet someone, I'm going to have to at least play a part in it. So if I have to go drive to meet you, hopefully something will come of it and it'll be worth my time. But
right.
if not, oh well. And so I didn't think anything of it. But when I would get to the dates, they're like, oh my God, like my friends are so worried. Like they don't know if you're going to kidnap me or something. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry that you felt that way. I had no intention of making you feel that way. For me, it's just, I'm willing to put in some work to try and make a relationship happen. So she just wanted to let me know that her friends were watching her phone's location, to see if like she went off whatever our plan was to make sure she was safe.
Right. One thing that a member of our 1A text club writes, they wrote, I'd like to have sex, but as a 30-year-old woman, I've had enough of men. I've lost my respect for them after sexual harassment and general entitlement. Sam, how has the Me Too movement affected sex and dating for you?
I think personally, it kind of scares me away a little bit from approaching people at, you know, bars or restaurants or maybe at a live concert or something like that. You never want to put someone in a position of being uncomfortable and then, you know, you approach them and say, hey, can I buy you a drink? They don't want to. Sometimes people don't feel comfortable saying no. So maybe that might put them in an awkward spot, but maybe they just came by themselves because they just wanted to come to a show by themselves, or they wanted to go grab a drink by themselves. So you don't want to bother them. And you also don't want to make them feel uncomfortable. So that's definitely kind of played a factor into my role in real life dating.
Gigi Engel, before I have you chime in, I'd love to get your thoughts on what we're hearing from Sam, but this idea of losing respect for men came up in a few comments, including this one that landed in our inbox.
Hi, I'm calling in response to the question about if you're having less sex than you would want or that you used to have. And my answer is yes, I am having less sex because I've realized that men are trash and I don't have to have sex with them. So, thanks. Bye.
Some very strong views on men today. Gigi Engel, what stands out to you from what we're hearing from Sam?
Well, I was first going to say I was going to applaud Sam for driving an hour to meet somebody. I mean, with dating apps, like nobody has an attention span anymore. It's like kind of amazing that somebody would drive an hour to meet somebody. But yeah, location sharing, I find that it's interesting that as opposed to like maybe before dating apps became a thing, somebody would be like, wow, I can't believe you drove an hour to meet me. That's so nice. It's like now we're like, I think you're a serial killer. So
right.
I put a location sharing thing on my phone and I'm letting you know, so don't try to kidnap mm-hmm. me. So I think that's really interesting. As far as like the Me Too movement, I don't think that it should be affecting anybody's ability to go up to somebody at a concert or a bar and say hi. I mean, if you're not going to assault or harass somebody, you don't really have anything to worry about. So in that regard, I don't think that the Me Too movement has done anything except make women be less afraid to say no when they aren't interested in a romantic advance.
Is this the new normal, or is there hope for the sex lives of 20-somethings today? That's ahead. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Capital One. Here's Sarah Strauss, head of fraud at Capital One, on how the CreditWise app helps users take action after receiving one of its automatic credit alerts.
It's not just an alert, but it's also, here are the next steps that we recommend you do. And so hopefully that's giving our users the opportunity to feel empowered to go after the issue and resolve it.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
Hey, just a quick reminder, your support is what keeps 1A and NPR on the air. We provide that rare space that promotes open dialogue, where everyone feels welcome and everyone feels heard. We are in no one's pocket but the pocket of those who keep us going. That's you. So please, make a donation at donate.npr.org/1A. Thanks. Sam, I'd love to get your thoughts before we have to let you go on kind of where you would like to see things go for you. What's your ideal? What are you looking for that seems kind of hard to access right now?
Sure. Well, first of all, I will be moving city soon, so I think that is going to help just to kind of get into an area with, you know, a few more people of my age and kind of life stage. Ideally, I think personally, I would like to be in a relationship of some sort in the not so distant future. How that comes to be, I don't know that I have a preference, but I do find that with the old fashioned way of dating and becoming, you know, starting a relationship as kind of friends first and then having that develop, I think it definitely provides a more stable relationship and definitely a better connection between two people. And so I think maybe just getting used to the idea that that may not be how things start and that the relationship may take a little bit longer to go through the normal stages of relationships and mm-hmm. getting comfortable with each other is going to be something that I have to get used to, but I think I'm open to it.
How much is your move related to trying to find a more fruitful, deeper dating pool?
It was a huge part. I like to have a good work-life balance, and I think moving into a new city will hopefully provide me with some more options for a social life and just, you know, getting involved in, you know, recreational sports or clubs or things like that. And then just being in an environment where you can meet more people around your age that hopefully share some of the same views. I found, just as an aside with dating apps, sometimes you can kind of use a biased lens when you're looking at someone's just immediate profile.
Yeah.
And you can rule people out based on one or two things that, you know, maybe won't actually be that big of a deal, but you're just having those preconceived notions, so you kind of rule them out ahead of time.
And hey, Sam, one last question I want to ask you, and I know this is a really uncomfortable question to hit you with right at the end, but since we are talking about dating and sex, I wonder if you as a man feel that it is socially acceptable to ask a woman for sex without the prospect of a relationship, if there is someone you are attracted to. I don't even know if that's an interest of yours, but do you feel that you have permission to say that, to say, listen, I don't know where this is going, but I think you're really attractive and I wonder if you and I could have fun? Is that even on the table?
I don't necessarily think that that's something that I personally would do. Usually I try to take a little more time with it. But I feel like that's something that would just kind of be something you read in the moment. And then maybe depending on how that goes, I don't know. I as long as the two people involved or however many people involved are consenting to everything, that is up to them. I guess I don't really know how to approach that just casual, you know, we just met today, let's have sex kind of
right.
talk. Just because I've never had the urge to do that. So I don't quite know how to answer that. I would be careful both ways, man and woman approaching each other, or man, woman, woman, doesn't matter.
You've never had the urge to do that, or you've never had the opportunity to do that?
I think just from a personal kind of value set, I just kind of make sure to have a little bit more of a foundation before that conversation comes up.
All right. Fair enough. Sam Hazelwood in Virginia. Best of luck with your move, Sam. And really, this isn't easy to discuss. So we appreciate you being willing to be open about this. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Sure. Thank you.
Jill wrote on our Facebook page, I think the rise of sex positivity actually has quite a bit to do with it. A big part of the sex positivity movement is conversations about consent and respecting people's boundaries.
Absolutely. So it's clear that it's more socially acceptable and that more people feel comfortable saying no to things that they don't want to do. And that's really a good thing. One thing that's interesting about this moment that we're in, though, is that we are in this sort of national resetting, I would say, almost. And we haven't kind of caught up to that. So certain things people are approaching with more care and more caution. I talked to, you know, not most of the young men I spoke to, but a healthy subset who said, I am really more worried now about making the first move and doing something that might be unwelcome or that somebody might perceive as, you know, unwanted. And so I'm just going to back off. And this is fascinating to me because there's quite a bit of data that suggests that most men, contrary to popular perception, I think, would actually like women to make the first move more. And yet the vast majority of women are not doing this either, whether this is expressing romantic interest, asking somebody out, initiating sex. It's just not very common still. And so if we really want to sort of take advantage of this moment as a reset, I think, you know, women need to step up a little bit.
Gigi Engel, we've been talking a lot about the influence of the web on sexuality and dating. One thing I wanted to make sure we got to is reflected in a tweet we got from a man, Pastor Drew Jones, who tweeted, pornography promises the thrills without the vulnerabilities of a real relationship. A lot's been made about the impact of pornography, both to give unreasonable expectations about sex and also to depict other forms of sexuality that help people identify who they are and what they're into and things like that. What do you think is the factor of pornography today on young people's sex lives?
On young people's sex lives, I think that pornography has unfortunately become sort of our default sex education, which is the fault of the American sex ed system, which is either non-existent or the best you might get is having a, you know, middle-aged woman putting a condom on a banana is like the best you're going to see. You're never going to hear the word clitoris. You're not going to see hear about female pleasure. It's not valued. We call the vulva the vagina, even though the vagina is the canal. So when you see when you don't have the tools to know what real sex is like because you haven't been taught about it, your default is going to be pornography. There's nothing inherently wrong with pornography. It's meant to be entertainment. It's not meant to be real life. But when it's the only thing you have, it's the only thing that you learn from, which ends up creating these unrealistic expectations around sexuality. Women think that they need to have these tiny waists and blonde hair and giant boobs and no hair on their vulvas whatsoever in order to be attractive. And men think they have to have these gigantic penises. And there's no attention paid to the clitoris, which is why the gender gap exists in the first place. So pornography, on top of that, has also become increasingly better. Like, if you look at your Pornhubs and your RedTubes, like, it's a lot of garbage, and it's pretty much just, like, gangbangs and threesomes and the same stuff made over and over again. But there are a lot of really...
These are websites. It's kind of like a YouTube for pornography, for lack of a better
definition. Yeah, just like the free pornography you can get on the internet. But there are a lot of really great pornographers who are making excellent porn, like Erica Lust. And if you look at things on Trenchcoat X, and, like, yes, they are behind a paywall, but it is so much better as far as representation of different body types, different relationships, different bodies in general. And that, but that is, and while that is great and it gives you a more substantial form of entertainment, we're so wrapped up with pornography and our dating apps and able to swipe as much as we want and no real need to connect with anybody that it does have the potential to make us a little bit more antisocial.
I do want to acknowledge, by the way, of course, this is, we've been talking a lot about sex and dating in heterosexual context. We have heard from quite a few of you who are LGBT. I am gay myself, so that is definitely not something that is lost on us. There's also another aspect of non-heterosexuality that at least two of you have commented on. Ben emailed, could the decline in interest in sexual acts among young people be due to an increased visibility for people in the asexuality community? It's included in LGBTQIA, but is rarely discussed in relation to such issues. Another member of the 1A Text Club writes, I'm 21 and have never had sex in my life, and I've never felt like I'm missing anything big. I'm not asexual, just have better things to do with my time. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Another factor that came up from a number of you is also referenced in a voicemail we got from Hannah in Indianapolis. Here's what Hannah left in our inbox.
I'm 27, and I feel like a lot of people my age struggle with mental health issues, but it's kind of a catch-22 because when you're depressed, you don't really feel like having sex, but a lot of times the depression medication side effect is that you have a decreased sex drive, so it just feels a little bit stuck sometimes.
Yeah, Hannah, thanks for sharing your story with us. Dr. Solomon, could you respond to this, particularly whether we might be talking about two slightly different but connected things? I'm hearing sex in terms of, like, you know, instances of intercourse, but then this text about touch and affection, that feels like it's like there's a Venn diagram there.
I agree. You know, the listener who is writing about feeling so alone in it, I think that one of the problems with the shame and stigma that remains around mental health is that people do feel reluctant to share their stories. And in fact, it's by sharing our stories that we can see and imagine possibilities for moving forward. And, you know, this gets into an entire conversation about our mental health system and how difficult it is for many people to access services that would be helpful. And certainly with depression and anxiety, we know that medication can be a really important component, but therapy is a really important component too. Individual therapy, couple therapy, group therapy. It's just is really an important aspect of emotional health. And I think that for somebody who's single, to not have a desire for sex reminds us also that much of our sexual desire is cultivated in the context of a loving and committed relationship. And so this fear of commitment, you know, fear of getting it wrong, or fear that nobody, that the shame that can keep us from partnering up can compromise our sexual desire. And so I often want to remind people that it's by coupling, it's by saying, listen, I'm drawn to you, I'm not perfect, you're not perfect, but let's try something together. And then allowing the sexuality to grow from there, rather than it being some a priori kind of experience.
And worth noting that even people in relationships are having trouble having as much sex as they say that they would like. I wonder if we could work our way around very, very briefly, Gigi, starting with you, for young people who are trying to figure out what their ideal is and how to attain it. Briefly, what would you suggest?
I think it has a lot to do with self-awareness and also the conversations that we're having with our children, our teenage children, about sexuality and about what a healthy sex life looks like. There's no such thing as having too much sex or too little sex or having it too early or too late. It's really about what is right for you. And we need to be able to communicate our own desires and our own needs and learn about our bodies and learn about anatomy and understand what a clitoris is in order to be able to move forward and understand the feelings we want to have in our first sexual experiences. I know that so many people have had these first-time experiences where they were like, wow, sex is not great. And that's because they didn't know about their bodies. They didn't know the sort of stimulation that they needed. They weren't connected in an emotional way with their partner. They just wanted to, you know, get their virginity out of the way. And I think if we are able to change the conversations around sexuality to be much more about how you want to feel and the intimacy you wish to have, we're going to have so many more young people who have positive experiences.
Gigi Engel, a certified sex coach, writer, and educator. Gigi, thanks for spending this hour with us.
Thanks. It's been great.
Dr. Alexandra Solomon, a licensed clinical psychologist and clinical assistant professor at Northwestern University's Family Institute and the author of Loving Bravely, 20 Lessons of Self-Discovery to Help You Get the Love You Want. Thank you, Dr. Solomon.
Thanks for having me.
And Kate Julian, senior editor at The Atlantic. A link to her article is online at the1a.org. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks so much.
This conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup.